From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Every 2 years when there's a congressional election, there's also a really, really tough federal anti-crime bill. And that is the second, you know, wave in the criminal justice buildup. And that's when you get a renewed round of supplying and training police and get more of all the things that were supplied in the 70s. More SWAT teams, more dogs, more helicopters, more computers, more body armor, along with mandatory minimums and increased power for prosecutors to try their cases, etc., etc.
Lockdown America, police and prisons in the age of crisis. Also a look at a precedent-setting case at the Corcoran State Prison in California. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Millions joined unprecedented anti-war marches in Colombia's main cities, and rebel leaders insisted at the inauguration of peace talks that it will take more than a simple rejection of violence to end the country's 35-year conflict. Members of a citizens' peace movement marched yesterday in 15 cities and dozens of smaller towns for a ceasefire, a rapid settlement, and an end to violence against civilians, the conflict's principal victims, waving red, blue, and yellow Colombian flags and chanting slogans like, "For peace, not one more shot. For peace, not one more kidnapping." Hundreds of thousands streamed through the main avenues of Bogota, Medellin, and Cali, the country's three biggest cities. And this news from New York, a controversial Ku Klux Klan rally in Manhattan ended yesterday with several arrests and a few injuries. 16 Klan members were joined by two skinheads outside a courthouse that was flanked by an estimated 6,000 anti-Klan protesters. Police reported seven arrests, all counter-demonstrators, on a variety of charges, including one man who allegedly assaulted a Klansman just prior to the rally. The rally followed days of legal haggling in which New York City said the Klansmen could gather only if they did not cover their faces. A court upheld the city's position. And on Friday in Minneapolis, police arrested three people as they and others marched this past Friday to protest police brutality. The march was part of a nationwide series of events held by the October 22nd Coalition, the Stolen Lives Project. The October 22nd Coalition has become known as the National Day Against Police Brutality. We're joined now on the telephone by Sin. She is one of the people who are at that protest in Minneapolis. Sin, can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, we'd had a protest down at the police station and were marching away. The police had showed up in great numbers. They were nudging us on the curb with their cop cars, yelling at us to get on the sidewalk. The police stopped their cars and got out, confronted the demonstrators, and grabbed two of them out of the crowd, threw them on the ground, kicked them and kneed them, and dragged them violently into the police car and arrested them. A third one went out to try and inquire as to why they were brutalizing his friends. He, too, was thrown to the ground and dragged into the police car. And then the police followed the nonviolent protesters and opened up a can of pepper spray on the whole crowd, of demonstrators.
Ultimately, how many people were arrested?
There were three arrests.
Well, thank you very much for that report. Sin speaking to us from Minneapolis, part of an ad hoc citizens coalition that was protesting police brutality last Friday. In this international news from Paris, Maurice Papon, the former Vichy official convicted of helping send Jews to their deaths at Auschwitz, will not request a presidential pardon in the immediate future, says his lawyer. Papon, who is 89, fled France before his court appeal last week, saying he was choosing exile over prison to uphold his honor. He was captured in Switzerland after a brief manhunt returned to a French prison. He's begun serving a 10-year sentence for complicity in crimes against humanity committed during World War II while he was a high-ranking police official in Bordeaux. And Illinois Governor George Ryan continues his mission to Cuba today. Ryan and a delegation of political and business leaders will meet with independent journalists and opponents of Fidel Castro's government. Ryan's also scheduled to meet to visit a children's hospital to present a donation of medical supplies. In all, the delegation is delivering over $1 million in humanitarian aid during a five-day visit to the island. The Republican governor and members of his party oppose the 1962 trade embargo against Cuba. Four members of a banned Chinese opposition party defended themselves in court against charges of subversion today before the trial. Judges ordered them to be silent, this according to a human rights group. Held under tight security, the trial of the four leading members of the China Democracy Party adjourned without a verdict in the eastern city of Hangzhou. This according to the Hong Kong-based Information Center of Human Rights and Democratic Movement in China. Subversion is among the most serious charges the government uses against political critics. Other principal members of the China Democracy Party have been given 8 to 13-year prison terms for the crime in an 11-month-long crackdown against the group. And this news from Denver, the suicide of the mother of a Columbine shooting victim is triggering painful memories for some people in Littleton, Colorado. Counselors have been working full-time to help those saddened by the death of Carla Hochhalter. Her daughter suffered injuries to her spinal cord, back, and chest when two gunmen fired at her in the Columbine High School parking lot last April. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The prosecution rested its case last week in the precedent-setting trial of four California prison guards at the Corcoran State Prison, accused of setting up the rape of a prisoner by another prisoner in order to punish him, after the jury heard from the victim, his attacker, and a whistleblowing guard. The incident took place in March of 1993 at the Corcoran State Prison near Fresno, a place notorious for its violence, where guards set up gladiator-style fights amongst prisoners and took bets on who would win. In graphic and wrenching testimony, former prisoner Eddie Dillard described how guards at the prison near Fresno locked him up in a cell with a 6'2", 220-pound notorious sexual predator named Wayne Robertson, also known as the Booty Bandit, despite the fact that Eddie Dillard begged them not to because he and Robertson were known enemies. Dillard said he was then raped repeatedly for 3 days until he was finally let out of the cell. According to Dillard, the guards wanted to punish him for kicking a guard. The jury last week also heard from the Booty Bandit himself, who said the guards had instructed him to teach Dillard how to do his time and had laughed at Dillard when he told them that his life was in danger. One of the guards responsible for locking Dillard up with his attacker, Roscoe Pondexter, also testified last week against his former colleagues. Known as the Bone Crusher for his strength and ability to beat prisoners up, Pondexter provided key testimony about the intent of the guards that day, who were punishing Dillard. We're joined right now by the Los Angeles Times reporter who has broken a number of stories around this case and is following the trial. Mark Arax is with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mark.
Good morning.
Well, can you tell us about the prosecution's case as it wrapped up last Friday?
Well, I think the prosecution was fairly successful in showing that there was good reason for the officers to know that they were putting Dillard into the cell of a man who had a dozen prison rapes in his prison file. Dillard was very effective telling his story, how he put the guards on alert more than once on the walk over from one section of the security housing unit to the other section where Robertson was celled, how he told them that they were documented enemies, that the man was a known rapist, and his life would be in danger if he was put in that cell. Of course, the officers are basically, their defense is one of ignorance, that they didn't know that Robertson had this past, and that Dillard never told them that on the way over. So the prosecution was pretty successful. You know, trials sometimes can be circumscribed in a way that the whole truth doesn't come out, and in this case, evidence of a fairly elaborate cover-up has not come into the trial. And that cover-up allegedly included canceling a rape exam by an outside doctor and then reports that were essentially destroyed. Some of the guards were disturbed enough about this to actually write reports, and those reports never made their way up through the system. Somehow they just got lost along the way.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that there are just four prison guards who are on trial, before the trial started, there was another person, a fifth, who was dropped. Who was he?
That was an officer named Jeff Jones, who was actually given the report that was done by an officer named Koziar, a man of some conscience, and he gave him the report, and Jones' basic response is, I'm not going to do anything with this. I can't do anything. And so when they dropped the charges against Jones, that whole nexus to the cover-up then was lost.
Can you talk a little about Roscoe Pondexter, the police guard who ultimately, the prison guard who ultimately was kicked out of Corcoran, who you wrote about a while ago in the Los Angeles Times, that basically opened up this case? I mean, it was a case, the case of the rape of Eddie Dillard, that took place, what, 6 years ago?
Well, most of the stories that we have been done on the strength of evidence from guards who have come forward with their stories. I think if we look back 3-4 years from now and see maybe some problems with the way all of the press out here in California covered this, is that none of us have ever listened to the inmates. There were a number of cases that were filed by inmates at Corcoran State Prison regarding the Gladiator Day fights and other kinds of alleged brutalities. And had we been going into court looking up these cases, we might have been able to find out about this, in time back in the early 1990s as opposed to the mid and late 1990s. So I had four or five prison guards come forward about the Gladiator Days in 1996, and I had heard at the time that Pondexter also had some stories of brutality and had been fired. So I made a run at him early on and was unsuccessful, and then later attempted again to contact him. And this time he seemed to be ready to talk. A lot of this had to do with what he felt was his own redemption. Came from a religious family, had left Corcoran, and as he had gotten further away from that experience, he saw more and more what had happened there and wanted to talk about it. So I approached him. And in talking to us, it was a situation that could put him in some real trouble because, as you know, his story, we have no power to give him any immunity. He basically decided to tell his story and let the chips fall where they may with regard to whether the state or the feds would then prosecute him. So approached him over a 3-day period. Actually went to his wife first. His wife was also a prison guard, and tried to get her to see maybe the wisdom in him talking. And he began to tell the story of that day. This was one of the things that really tugged at his conscience over the past 4 or 5 years. And so he told his story. We wrote about it in a piece that also kind of played Pondexter off of Dillard. It was from that that then the state made it approached him, and he decided to come forward with some immunity.
Would you say, Mark Arax, that this is a precedent-setting case?
Well, it's the first time in nearly a decade that the prison officers at Corcoran, the deadliest prison in America, have been prosecuted. So in that way, it's precedent-setting. It's very rare that correctional officers are put on trial here. You know, each of these prisons are located in usually they're located in very small towns, very small counties. DAs do not have the resources to go after these cases. Oftentimes when they do, the very powerful prison guard union then goes after those DAs and ends up supporting in a very big way opponents in with campaign contributions. So there's not a whole lot of incentive for DAs to go after these things. So, yes, in that way, it's precedent-setting. next March, I think we're going to have a federal trial that will really get to the heart of what was going on at Corcoran, and that was the Gladiator Day fights and then the shooting policy based on what was called the integrated yard policy.
And if you can explain that, because while it got some attention with some 60 Minutes expose about guards killing, setting up prisoners to fight and then to shoot them dead, it hasn't gotten the kind of drumbeat coverage that this kind of case deserves.
You had two things coming together with that. You had an integrated yard policy and then a shooting practice. The integrated yard policy, in the words of the whistleblowers and other officers, was a very cynical attempt by the state of California to actually integrate rival inmates, inmates who were sworn enemies from the streets and then in the prison gangs. And what they said was cynical about it is, I mean, the whole rationale was, we will integrate these guys because we need to show that they can get along inside the smaller security housing unit, and if they can, then we'll release them to the general yard. The problem with that is that even on the general yard, all these gangs, they segregate themselves. So the whole idea of integrating sworn enemies in a tiny, tiny concrete yard was crazy. And when the inevitable happened, when these guys fought, there was a shooting practice and a shooting policy that gave the guards who in the gunner position really no choice but to fire wood-block guns to break up the fight. And if the wood-block guns did not succeed in breaking up the fight, then came out the real bullets. And this was an extraordinary practice that was done only in the California prison system. And some 50 inmates were seriously wounded or killed at Corcoran as part of a larger practice. And this just didn't happen at Corcoran. It happened at prisons, maximum security prisons, up and down the state. And it wasn't until we did our pieces last year that the practice finally stopped.
Mark Arex is a reporter with the Los Angeles Times, who's been covering the Corcoran State Prison Guards trial that is taking place and has been covering Corcoran for a while. Mark, what is expected to happen now with the defense presentation of their case? When do they start? And these four guards who are now on trial, Dale Breakbill, Joe Sanchez, Anthony Silva, and Robert Decker, they be taking the stand in their own defense?
Yes, the defense starts today. There's indications from their attorneys that at least two of them will be taking the stand. The interesting one is going to be Sergeant Decker. His attorneys have not yet decided whether or not he's going to take the stand. He is the one, if you believe the prosecution, who set this whole thing in motion. He was kind of a shot caller, as they would say, for the officers. He kind of headed that unit, and as such, he would have to know who Wayne Robertson was, because Wayne Robertson was a shot caller on the inmate side of things. And so it's going to be interesting to see how they play with this whole contention that he didn't know Robertson. So whether or not he gets up in his own defense will be an interesting call that'll play out this weekend. Tiny little town of Hanford.
And Wayne Robertson's testimony again, would you say it was very damning, and can he be believed?
Well, that's going to be the big question. One of the things that Robertson said himself is that, you know, I am evil, but even out of the mouth of evil, you know, the truth can come. And it's going to be interesting. I mean, the jury selection, you know, you have to remember that the officers on trial are all white and Latino. The jury is all white and Latino. It's a prison town, a prison and farming town. And the three men whose stories really make up the prosecution case, Robertson, the assailant, Dillard, the victim, and Roscoe Pondexter, the whistleblowing guard, are all black. So there is a racial component here. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out also.
Well, Mark Arax, I want to thank you for being with us. Mark Arax is a Los Angeles Times reporter who has broken a number of stories around what is happening at the Corcoran State Prison as we continue to follow the trial of the four prison guards accused of setting up the rape of a young prison inmate. Mark Arax is also author of the book In My Father's Name, A Family, A Town, A Murder. And it is the true story of his own family and the murder of his father in Fresno, California, years ago. With us, Mark Arax.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we take a look at police and prisons in the age of crisis. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. In California, spending for prisons has surpassed spending for higher education. The prison guard lobby is one of the most powerful in the state. Almost 2 million Americans are currently in prison, a 300% increase since 1980. In several cities, including Washington, D.C., one-third of all young African-American men are either in jail, on probation, or awaiting trial. Starbucks, JanSport, Microsoft are just some of the many corporations that use prison labor to package their products. These are not accidental events, nor do they reflect a rise in crime in the past decade. In fact, while crime has been steadily dropping, the nation's prison population continues to swell and to become younger. Today we're going to take a look at the political and economic reasons behind the massive crackdown and the growing prison population with Christian Parenti, who is a professor at the New College of California in San Francisco and author of a new book called Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. He's worked as a radio journalist for Pacifica in Central America, New York, and California, and has also written for The Nation in these times, The Progressive, and The Christian Science Monitor. This was a speech he recently gave as his book, Lockdown America, was released.
The reason I wrote this book was because about 10 years ago, living in San Francisco, I just saw more and more police repression, and the explanation that myself and my friends were using didn't actually work. You know, we used the model from Central America that, okay, this is an emerging police state to put down dissent, but actually the people who were being jacked up and thrown in jail and brutalized weren't organized, and they weren't dissenting, and so it didn't quite make sense. There wasn't a movement being repressed, but I knew that this was political. I didn't think, oh, this is just apolitical, this is just about public safety. I knew this was like an inherently political thing. You have the power of the state coming down on working class youth of color. That's what was happening in the neighborhood I lived in. So that was political, and I wanted to figure that out, so started writing articles, and then this book. And I think to really answer the question as to why we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and why we spend billions upon billions of dollars on police technology and surveillance, and why we have some of the best armed and best equipped and most aggressive police officers in the industrialized world, you have to go back to the 1960s and look at the dual crisis faced by American capitalism and the American political system. So this is the first part of the book. The dual crisis is this, and I'll deal with the components separately. First, there's a political economic crisis, which is global and hits the U.S. in the mid and late 60s. And that is a crucial part of the story. But there's also the political crisis of mass rebellion, social movements, and massive rioting in the 60s. And these two crises that happened in the late 60s, I think, are really the origin of the current crackdown. So let's begin with the political, the criminal justice political crisis. In the 1960s, as you all know, is a time of massive social upheaval. You have the civil rights movement, which transmogrifies into the Black Power movement. The Black Panthers, the Young Lords arise, and they're demanding not only an end to segregation and racism, but a redistribution of wealth down the hierarchy to working people in general. You've got the National Welfare Rights Organization demanding that welfare be made available to everyone who needs it, but essentially demanding that there be a minimum national income in the U.S., basically demanding European-style social democracy. And you also have unorganized rebellion, massive rioting. Recall that in 1967, over 150 cities exploded in rioting. And we look back on this era and we see the role of repression often as, you know, crushing the movement. The police killed Fred Hampton, the leader of the Black Panthers, in Chicago, framed people in the movement left and right, and it seems in retrospect that repression worked. That demobilized the movement. But if you go back into the middle of it, there was a moment there when it didn't look like that. In the mid-60s, there was a serious police failure. And as far as the economic and policy elites of the U.S. were concerned, that is, the people who own the major corporations and sit on their boards, who sit on the boards of the major foundations and who, you know, are elected or appointed representatives in government, when 150 cities were exploding summer after summer, it looked like policing was not working. And in fact, it wasn't. The best example of this was the 1968 Democratic Convention, where the police went in and cracked heads, and it didn't dispel the movement. It didn't put the genie back in the bottle. In fact, it made things worse. It split the Democratic Convention down the middle. You had mainstream Democrats calling for a suspension of the convention to move out of Chicago because Daley was a thug. It created an international spectacle. So that was an example of too much repression, creating a horrible spectacle, radicalizing and mobilizing people even more. At other times, the police applied too little repression. For example, I use that not in a moral sense, like that they should have applied more, but just in a pure technical sense, they didn't apply enough repression often. For example, in Watts, where there was a small riot developing and there was chaos between all the police units that were there, the CHP, the Sheriff's Department, and the LAPD, and so they withdrew, and that's when you get the 65 riot in Watts. So policing in the late 60s is marked by either too much repression, not enough repression, confusion, lack of coordination, turf fighting, total chaos. And the federal government realizes in around 67, 68 that this has to change. And the form that that change takes is the 1968 Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act, which is passed through Congress literally as Washington, D.C. is on fire. There's smoke billowing out of the southeast, and that concentrates the minds of the representatives to pass this bill. And what the bill does is it creates this huge federal bureaucracy called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, or the LEAA. And for the next 10 years, the LEAA's function was to funnel about $1 billion a year, along with military and managerial expertise and technology, to local policing, so as to retool and rationalize American policing. Among the components that are the legacies of this great leap forward are all of the basics of modern policing, such as computers, body armor, shoulder radios, helicopters, SWAT teams, expansion in canine teams, basic training such as learning to read. Previously, most major police departments had lower qualification standards than beauticians. You literally had to train more to give a manicure than you did to carry a gun and patrol the city. And one former LEAA administrator told me about how he got a grant application from a sheriff in Missouri that was signed with an X. The guy was completely illiterate. So problems like that were taken care of thanks to this massive infusion of federal cash and federal expertise. Another really crucial component of what I would call the emerging anti-crime police state, because we don't yet have a police state. Of course, it still is a liberal democracy, but we have the core of something that is increasingly looking like a police state. So another key component of that, which comes out of this 60s leap forward, is the National Crime and Information Center, the first national database of people that the government, that the FBI and the police want to keep tabs on. So that's the first wave in the current buildup in criminal justice, is this federally funded reorganization, rationalization, this federally funded great leap forward in American policing that was a response to the police crisis of the 60s, the failure of the police to contain and control social movements and rioting. So we'll come back to the story of the criminal justice buildup and shift to the other part of the dual crisis of the 60s, which is the political economic crisis. What happens is that beginning in the late 60s, after-tax profit rates, average after-tax profit rates, take a nosedive from around an average of 10% in the mid-60s down to like 3% in the early 70s. So suddenly, big business in America is gripped with a serious economic crisis. The roots of that crisis go back to World War II. Now, just briefly, the post-war economic history is this. As you all know, World War II leaves Europe and Japan, the two other industrial poles of the capitalist world economy, completely devastated. Not only are lots of people killed, but remember, lots of things, lots of capital is destroyed, completely destroyed. So they're devastated. The U.S. emerges from the war with its industrial capacity greater than it has ever been, producing, some estimates put it at 40%, some estimates put it at 50% of the world's GDP at that point. And to ensure stability against communism and for a whole bunch of other reasons, the U.S. invests massively in rebuilding Japan and Europe. And U.S. business profits incredibly off of the 20-year process of rebuilding and reindustrialization and recovery in Europe and Japan. And at the same time, many countries in the Third World, the newly industrialized countries such as, which now wouldn't be considered Third World, but you know, South Korea, Taiwan, Mexico, Turkey, are starting to really industrialize at the same time. And U.S. corporations are in a perfect position to reap the lion's share of the benefits throughout the 50s and the late 40s, 50s, and early 60s. And that creates average after-tax profit rates that were unprecedentedly high, around 10%, as I said, as opposed to an average of, you know, between 4 or 5 and maximum 6% historically. But by the mid-late 60s, Japan has recovered, Europe has recovered, the newly industrialized countries are you know, joining the game. All of these economies are supplying their own markets, their domestic markets, which means U.S. corporations are losing what's called market share. And then they're also starting to import or export to the U.S. market. So that by the late 60s, you have a saturation in world consumer markets. And there's just too much stuff to go around. Of course, there's tons of human need. You know, there's plenty of poverty, people who need shoes and education and drinking water. But human need is different from economic demand. Human need only becomes effective, what economists call effective demand, if people have money to meet those needs. So the people who did have money to meet their needs pretty much had all of the washing machines, automobiles, and blue jeans that they needed at that point. And the industrial economy was capable of putting out way more than could be absorbed. So this crisis of overproduction, or what's sometimes called a crisis of overaccumulation, leads to heightened competition, price slashing, dumping of products in you know, different markets, and a rising costs and basically plummeting profits. So that becomes a serious crisis that the American business class and policy elites realize they have to deal with. And the solution doesn't really arrive until 1980 with Ronald Reagan. So what happens then is, after attempts to try and, you know, rectify this problem, what the policy elites realize is that, okay, we can't really deal with this crisis of overproduction. You can't make all of the goods in the world go away. But we can at least take away some of the gains that working people and consumers have won throughout the 30s and the 1960s. Labor's share of the pie had gotten bigger. And in this time of crisis, capital, that is, large businesses, looked at the share of the economic pie that workers were getting, and they thought, well, if we want to boost profit rates, it has to come out of that sliver, that section of the pie. The way that's dealt with definitively is with the election of Ronald Reagan and the appointment of Paul Volcker to be chairman of the Federal Reserve. And it's actually Carter who appoints Volcker in 79. But then together, Volcker and Reagan engineer the most severe recession that the U.S. economy has seen since the Great Depression. For very political reasons, they deliberately raise interest rates to almost 16%, which has the effect of almost shutting off all economic activity. It becomes impossible to get loans, therefore to start businesses, go to school, whatever, so it's harder to get a job. There's less consumption, less economic activity, massive unemployment. And one of the reasons they did this, this was economists often called this a cold bath recession. It was a deliberate attempt to discipline and scare organized labor. Also, you have to recall that in the late 60s, early 70s, organized labor was, you know, getting really, really active. Rank and file movements, wildcat strikes that have been totally forgotten. For example, the entire postal system was shut down by a wildcat strike for up to 2 weeks in 1970. Two trucking strikes shut down the entire trucking system. I mean, every industry. The air traffic controllers were wreaking havoc. You name the industry, there was massive labor agitation, often in the form of wildcat strikes throughout the 70s. So this recession changes all of that. In 1980, not a single union from 64 to 1980, not a single union contract included a wage freeze or a wage give back. But then in 1982, just 2 years later, you know, into this recession, 44% of all union contracts either included wage freezes or outright give backs. So that's one of the effects of this recession, the salubrious economic effect of scaring the hell out of working people so that they'll work harder for less. Also on the political front, Reagan stacks the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, which is the organization that mediates labor disputes, stacks it with conservatives who hate labor, always rule against labor, does the same to the courts, slashes public assistance. You know, one of the first things he does is ends the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, which was sort of like a WPA program of the 70s. That alone throws 400,000 people onto the unemployment rolls, cuts AFDC radically, which puts another 500,000 people, you know, right out there looking for work, reduces spending for HUD, reduces, spending on education, basically launches an assault, a policy and an economic assault on all of the institutions that had cushioned working people, that had made it possible for working people to resist big businesses' attempt to take away their gains. And this does, in part, help boost profit rates and deal with that problem. But it also creates massive poverty and all of the instability and contradictions that go with that. You have the rise of homelessness again in the early 80s, the, you know, hyper-ghettoization of cities that are being, you know, having been burnt out in the 70s and deindustrialized in the late 70s and then really, really deindustrialized in the 80s. You've got this, you know, pockets of real intensified misery that need to be contained and controlled for fear that they might organize, explode, whatever, or at least get in the way and threaten, you know, the redevelopment of downtowns, et cetera, et cetera. So the solution to the economic crisis creates a social crisis that has to be managed somehow. Previously, poverty in the U.S. had been managed, of course, you know, with naked force often, you know, in the South and many places. But increasingly, you know, through the 60s, it had been managed through co-optation and amelioration, that people could be dealt in a little bit, bought off, and, given jobs, job training, whatever. to keep the lid on things and to keep people feeling that the system was okay. But that could no longer be done because that was making it difficult to discipline labor. The social welfare net that existed was making labor too strong. It was a subsidy to class war. A perfect example of this comes from the late 60s, where there was a huge strike against General Electric, which was like the fourth largest employer in the country. And due to all sorts of political agitation and radicalization, it was legal and popular for strikers to go on welfare. And the government ended up paying $25 million in welfare payments to these strikers who eventually won the strike against GE. So for the captains of industry, this was like treason. This, you know, this was state-subsidized class warfare. And that's how they see the effect of social democracy and the welfare net, whatever you would want to call it, those sorts of interventions that support people economically. So, all right, so how does this contradiction of, you know, renewed poverty get dealt with? Well, around the same time you have the birth of the war on drugs, the Reagan-era war on drugs, which really takes off in 1984 with the first large anti-crime, federal anti-crime bill of the Reagan era. And then you, and around that time you start seeing incarceration rates going up, which is, this is an important point actually. The buildup in the 70s was not matched by an increase in incarceration. Incarceration rates stayed pretty much level through the 70s, even though spending on policing went through the roof. But then in the 80s, incarceration rates really go up. So then 86, you have another crime bill, 88, and so on and so forth. And we've had one major federal crime bill after another every 2 years at least. Sometimes they have them on off years as well. These are, of course, to coincide with congressional elections, right? That's every 2 years when there's a congressional election, there's also a really, really tough federal anti-crime bill. And that is the second, you know, wave in the criminal justice buildup. And that's when you get a renewed round of supplying and training police and get more of all the things that were supplied in the 70s, more SWAT teams, more dogs, more helicopters, more computers, more body armor, along with mandatory minimums and increased power for prosecutors to try their cases, et cetera, et cetera.
Christian Parenti, he is author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. It's published by Verso Press, and we'll be back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with the speech of Christian Parenti. He's a professor at the New College of California in San Francisco and author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis.
So that's sort of the historical story in the book. And the argument that I'll get to in more detail later is that basically what's called the prison industrial complex has to be explained by looking at the needs of the class system as a whole, and not just by looking at the needs of specific corporations that may or may not be driving policy by using prison labor or by owning private prisons. Those are important interest groups, but what I argue is you have to go beyond the interest group model and have a holistic class analysis and look at what the political system and the economic structure in general needs. And that historical story of the shift from reform to repression, I think, helps explain it. So that's the first part of the book. Then I have a middle section on policing, the types of policing that have developed out of this, you know, great leap forward, this build-up in criminal justice, this incarceration binge. And then a third section on prison, which deals with life in prison, how prison is managed and controlled, the rollback of prisoners' rights, and then the prison industrial complex. And I'll get to that. But just the policing section deals with, for example, zero tolerance policing, and quality of life policing, the styles of policing that have developed in New York over the last 7 or 8 years, which are now being exported all over the country. That theory of policing is that if you control quote unquote disorder, such as people urinating on the street and spray painting, you will create a sense of regulation that will then prevent violent crime. The theory being that people only murder and rape when they feel that no one's looking and that the street is deserted and chaotic. And so that's the idea at the heart of this quality of life policing. And as a result of that, or with that scientific, pseudoscientific justification, police have been coming down, you know, with enormous force on everything from jaywalking to drinking in public. And I think that it actually has reduced crime, but at a terrible cost to civil liberties and human rights. So there's two sections on that also deal with not only just the policing angle, but the political economic geography of American cities. Why is it that this new style of policing has developed now? Part of it has to do with the new role of cities in the world economy and the sort of the return to cities of by capital, the reinvestment and rebuilding in central downtowns, turning places like San Francisco and New York into corporate cockpit cities and theme parks where the number one and number two economies are business services and tourism. And cities like that, when also inhabited by thousands and thousands of hungry poor people, require a certain type of very intense policing, and that's what quality of life is all about. But then I deal with SWAT teams, and there's also a section on the repatriation of the INS war on the border into the U.S. And that's, I think, one of the most important chapters in the book, because what goes on the border is some of the most sinister and pernicious policing in world history. And it happens because it's on the border. So people have allowed all sorts of cooperation between agencies that normally have nothing to do with each other, such as local police, the INS, and the military, because it's on the border and doesn't seem to apply here. But increasingly, these joint task forces and these, you know, militarily supplied and supported units of INS agents are making raids in the interior, in the pumpkin fields of Washington, the barrios of California, and in the Midwest, where there's a whole de-unionized meatpacking industry that is increasingly supplied with Latin American labor, and folks there are under the heel of very intense INS policing. But anyway, and the SWAT team chapter, I'll read just a bit of that to give you a taste of what the book sounds like in places. And this chapter opens with a look at the Fresno SWAT team, the Fresno Violent Crime Suppression Unit, which is the most aggressive SWAT team in the country. So, for a sneak preview of a future American police state, travel south from the comfortable illusions of the San Francisco Bay Area on Interstate 99 into the dirty air of California's Central Valley to Fresno, a sprawling, poorly planned city of 400,000. Past the forest of pole-perched McDonald's, Best Western, and Motel 6 signs, and turn off on one of the city's southern exits into the sprawling ghetto of the southwest side. There on the pocked streets, among the stucco bungalows and dying rail yards, one will find massive paramilitary police operations underway on almost any night of the week. It's a cold October evening. A helicopter clatters overhead, sweeping its lights across the shabby trees and flat homes. Nearby in the shadows, three squads of 10 police officers in combat boots, black fatigues, and body armor lock and load their Heckler & Koch MP-54 submachine guns, the same weapons used by the elite Navy SEALs, and fan out through the ghetto. Meet Fresno's Violent Crime Suppression Unit, or VCSU, local law enforcement's, quote, special forces and America's most aggressive SWAT team. Since 1994, these soldier cops have been conducting the criminal justice equivalent of search and destroy missions in Fresno's, quote, gang-ridden badlands. Quote, it's war, explains a police spokesperson. The way this SWAT team developed, or this paramilitary policing unit, as they're sometimes called, developed, was that normally SWAT teams are specially trained officers who only assemble as a group in case of emergency, and otherwise they patrol as normal police. And there was a series of gang shootings in which civilians were wounded or killed in 1994. And so in response to this very real crisis of violence, the chief of police sent in the SWAT team to assemble always together and to patrol the area, not to respond to emergencies, but to patrol regularly. So this is a little bit about what it was like when they started, when the VCSU started. Their immediate task was to round up a list of some 200 suspected repeat offenders and veteran gangbangers. The enemy was to be tracked down, busted, and put away for as long as possible. The operation involved raiding homes, stopping cars, interrogating, quote, suspicious persons, and storming an archipelago of, quote, hotspot corners. Bringing up the rear was the fawning Fresno Bee, the local paper, dishing out bang-bang copy. Quote, a special SWAT team armed with machine guns and dogs slipped into the city's south side Friday night with orders to take dangerous neighborhoods back from drug dealers and gang members, unquote. The city councilwoman from the besieged area called the police occupation long overdue, while the DA asserted that the only difference between the war in Sarajevo and gangbanging in Fresno was the lack of rocket launchers in the latter. Chief Winchester, enjoying the support and attention generated by his Scorched Earth campaign, soon institutionalized the emergency response, and the 30-member SWAT team became the Violent Crime Suppression Unit. In the name of crisis management, the VCSU was free to continue using aggressive and unorthodox tactics that combined old-time thuggery with pernicious high-tech. At times that meant cruising in a fleet of cars, at others it meant quietly deploying troops on foot to surround targets and sweep through patches of ghetto. The street corner raids usually began with police officers tossing, quote, flashbang grenades designed to stun and disorient suspects, then swooping in with barking dogs and guns drawn as they bellow orders to get down. Civilian-owned pit bulls, Rottweilers, and Dobermans were and still are shot on sight, while everyone in the targeted area was forced to the ground at gunpoint. As one team of 10 VCSU officers established an armed perimeter, another team would train guns on prostrate, quote-unquote, bad guys, while the third team would take photos, conduct field interviews, which is a term taken directly from the U.S. Army in Vietnam. That's what they used to call interrogations, field interviews. Run warrant checks, note tattoos, scars, clothing, distinguishing characteristics, addresses, and add all the new intelligence into local, state, and federal databases from the mobile computer terminals in each patrol car. Prisoners were carted away in a huge gray bus with SWAT emblazoned on the side that police likened to a rolling billboard. And they still do this, even though they're running out of crime to deal with. When I was hanging out with them, one of the most outrageous things I saw was some kid had brandished a gun, which is not in and of itself a crime in California unless you threaten someone with it. But the person who's threatened has to report it to police. But the person who had been threatened didn't actually report it to police. Someone else did. So they didn't have probable cause to go after this person. They weren't actually in hot pursuit. They couldn't enter buildings after this young man. But they went after him because they wanted to talk to him. They cornered him in his mother's house. They surrounded the house with 30 police officers. They brought in a helicopter, which was shining lights down and, you know, making a racket. They had their machine guns, their Heckler & Koch machine guns, trained on the house, lights flooding the house. And just so you know, like, the level of capitalization, the level of investment in the police, they're receiving on their brand new laptop computers in their cars, real-time infrared video feed from the helicopter, so they can see a map of what they're doing in real time and move their troops around the house. Joining them pretty soon are a bunch of sheriff's deputies and then regular police. And surrounding the whole scene are about 200 people from the neighborhood who are there watching and wondering why there's this helicopter, you know, 70 to 100 feet overhead for an hour or 45 minutes. And that helicopter eventually runs out of gas and goes back, and another one comes. And it was the most dramatic display of state power I'd ever seen firsthand. And it struck me that what this was it wasn't just about intimidating the people that the SWAT team or the VCSU were going after. It was a form of state-funded political theater for the entire neighborhood. They had lighting, they had props, they had costumes, and they had their script, their police vernacular and all that. And they had their audience, which was this working-class Latino neighborhood, watching this invasion of their neighborhood. And it seemed to me that this political theater was semaphore, was sending a message to the people, which was that we have as many resources as we need to keep you in your place, and we will do whatever it takes to keep you there. So don't think that you can step out of line, because we're here and we're in control, and we're going to do this every single night in your neighborhood, and we don't care if it wakes you up, and we don't care if you don't like it, because we have machine guns and we have dogs, and this goes on every night. It's a form of agitprop by the state, which is important to remember in terms of how terror works. You know, just because often people talk about using Foucault, who wrote a great book, Discipline and Punish, and he argues that the history of Western punishment is moving away from terror and away from assaults on the body towards getting people to police themselves and internalize control, and that terror is less and less central to control, but that the control becomes all the more efficient when terror is removed from the equation. But there's been a bifurcation. That's how some classes and, you know, races are regulated in this society. But there's, since the 70s, been a reemergence of the use of terror. And I think people miss it often because there aren't public executions, there aren't the old-fashioned rituals of terror. But if you look at what policing is, a lot of it is that. A lot of it is this public displays of terror. It's insinuating terror into the community, not by torturing people in public, as was the traditional method, but through these forms of political theater, sending this message. I think that really, really scares people, and that terror is a big part of how order is maintained in the U.S. So that's the policing section. Then the last section of the book, which has three or four chapters in it, deals with prisons. First, looking at why there wasn't a rise in incarceration in the 70s at the same time that there was this big expansion in policing power. Also looking briefly at prisoners' movements, how prisoners won the rights that they are now losing, such as, you know, the right to file lawsuits, the right to visit their families, all these other things. And they won it through political organizing and through suing and through rioting. But then on to the bad news, right? And all of that is being wiped away. And as those rights or privileges, as some would call them, are being lost, there's also a concomitant rise in terror by guards. So there's no coincidence that as politicians are demanding that prisoners can't read pornography, guards take their cues and start setting up fights on the yard in Corcoran and shooting people and betting on it. So there's a chapter that looks at that, and one, a lot of which is pretty colorful, some of which is, you know, kind of
Christian Parenti, professor at the New College of California in San Francisco, author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. It's a new book published by Verso Press in New York. Christian is a radio journalist with Pacifica and has written for The Nation, In These Times, The Progressive, The Christian Science Monitor, and yes, is the son of Michael Parenti. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Today's engineer is Matthew Finch. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!